Okay. Let's jump in then and talk about encountering atheists and skeptics. Notice at the top it talks about four major worldviews in the world. First one is monotheism. That is those religions that believe that there's one God. So Judaism, Christianity, Islam are the major ones. There's a few others. There's some minor religions like Zoroastrianism, which is located in a very a contained part of the world over between, I think, Pakistan and India or Afghanistan. There are a few others, but a large portion of the world believes in one God. Secondly, pantheism. A large portion of the world believes there are multiple gods, or that God is everywhere, or that everything is divine. This would include Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Shinto. A lot of the Eastern religions are pantheistic. And then the last two belief systems are two forms of atheism. One is called material naturalism. That is, all there is in this world are physical things. You're a physical thing. There's no soul. There's no real you. And then there's secular humanism. So let's take a look at these. And I would just say this, that I think one of the easiest types of people to talk to is an atheist. Why? Because when you look in Romans chapter 1, we're told every unbeliever in a tactic to try to get rid of the knowledge of God suppresses the truth of God. That is, they hold it down, they try to resist belief in the true God, and for most people in the world, then that results in worshiping some other religion. They're Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, whatever it might be. They believe that there's some God or deity out there. But when you meet someone who believes in no God whatsoever, you're dealing with somebody who's trying to deny the fundamental reality of the world. That is, we're told in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. That unbeliever has to live in a world where we're told in the Bible that everything in the world points toward God, and yet they're denying like it's there. Reminds me of a psychology experiment that took place a number of years ago where a whole class was in on the experiment. There was one person who didn't know what was going on. And so the teacher came in, and he held up a blue pen. He said, "Class, what color is this pen?" And everyone shouted red except the one person who was not in on the joke. He said, "No, it's blue." And everyone's like, "Are you crazy? It's red." And he's like, "No, how can you say that? It's clearly blue." And it didn't take more than a few minutes for the entire crowd to convince that one person to say, "Okay, I guess it's red. Maybe there's something wrong with my sight." When you're dealing with someone who denies the reality of God, they're denying something that God says is so obvious, Romans 1, that when they deny that reality, God says you're without excuse. There's no reason for you to believe that because everything in the world points to the existence of God. So let's take a look at two different types of atheism. The first one is material naturalism. What is it? It says all things ultimately can be reduced to material phenomenon or physical process. That is, everything is physical. The fact that you love kindness is just because you're programmed to do that. There is no God in the world. There's no soul. There's no spirit. Secondly, only scientifically verifiable statements can be considered knowledge. That is, you can't claim to know something unless it's scientific. This is one of the most basic things about this view. You can say, "Well, I know there's a God because I've prayed and he's answered requests." And they would say that's not knowledge because you can't really judge that. Those things could have happened anyways. Have you ever had anybody ask that question to you? So you prayed about something that came true. Wouldn't it have happened anyways? You prayed for someone to get better. They got better. How do you know that prayer made the difference? And it's very easy to start to cast doubts on those kind of things. And people who believe this would say then that only something that's scientific can be counted as knowledge. So that nothing that we love or hate or desire has any meaning. That is, you love the things that you love and you hate the things that you hate merely because you're programmed to do it. C.S. Lewis talks about this when he says, when a young man falls in love with a young woman and he begins to be amazed by her and he thinks about her all the time and she occupies his thoughts, will he have the same thoughts about her if he discovers that he was just programmed to be attracted to her just for mating purposes in nature? Will that change his view? And he says, yeah, because if that's all that is, then I'm not in wonder anymore. I'm programmed to do that, just like I'm programmed to eat food or drink water. He says, rather, when we think that there's a purpose or meaning behind it, that's when it matters to us. And here's some examples. Stephen Hawking, Richard Dawkins, Peter Atkins. There's many out there that teach this kind of thing. Richard Dawkins is probably the most famous atheist in the world. He's written the book, The God Delusion, where he says, basically, if you believe in God, you believe in a delusion, and you have no reason to believe it. And the sooner you give up that belief, the more you can join the rest of us enlightened people who are going to live in the world in the future. Well, what's wrong with this view? Well, it's not true science, but rather scientism. Maybe you've never seen that term before, scientism. It's turning science into basically the position of God. It's the belief that science is the sole arbiter of truth in the modern world. And this is not a new view. Again, C.S. Lewis, British author back in the 1950s and 60s, he's the one, I think, who coined the term, said even in his day, even 70 years ago, people were exalting science to be the answer to everything. And Lewis said, how can we believe that after two world wars? Right? What brought on World War I, what brought on World War II is the belief that we can solve our own problems through our technology, that we don't need God, and that we can do the things that we need to do in the world. And that is what caused that. And scientism is this belief that the only true way to knowledge is through science. So that the conflict is not truly between science and religion. Truth is, science is a wonderful gift from God. It's something we should appreciate. We are here having lights and air conditioning. That's thanks to science. We have technology in our pockets that help us to find our way home if you don't know how to get home. I guess find your way here and communicate with people. Everything from the Hubble Space Telescope, one of the most advanced things in the world, right down to your iPhone and the comforts that we have come from science. Science is a wonderful thing. It's a good gift from God. But when it is turned into the ultimate answer for everything, it goes beyond its abilities. So let's take a look at a few limitations of science then. First of all, science can only address the natural world. That is, science can't ask the question, does God exist? Because God is not a scientifically proven being. He is outside time, outside this world. Science is limited to the natural world. Secondly, all scientific data has to be interpreted. Again, when a scientist finds something, he has to ask the question, what is this and what is it for? Where does it fit into our human knowledge? That is, there is some interpretation that goes along with science. Sometimes scientists get that right, sometimes they get it wrong. Let's take, for example, two scientists, a Christian and a non-Christian, or a theist who believes in God and an atheist who doesn't believe in God. They can look in at the scientific data and agree, this is what we see through the microscope or through the telescope, this is the chemical reaction. But when you ask them, why is it the way it is and what does it mean, they're going to have two very different results. One is going to say, ultimately, this thing speaks of the glory of God and is designed for man's good in this life. The other is going to say, this is random and pointless. There's no one directing the process, and it's here merely for our survival. Well, those are two different interpretations, and sometimes people think that science just tells you what's there, but science also interprets what's there. Thirdly, science must constantly revise and rescind its pronouncements. Again, this is one of the limitations of science. This is the way science works. So we shouldn't have been surprised. I'm going to use some examples that hopefully will hit home. When COVID first came out, scientists were telling us one thing. And then as they studied how that thing worked, they thought, actually, maybe we ought to do this instead. That's the nature of science. That as new information comes, it changes their opinions on things. Now, science can also be corrupted by politics. We're well aware of that. But the very nature of science is as new information comes in, then their pronouncements, their decisions of what is true or what is real changes. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is a limitation. Think, for example, in the past how people were told that the sun was the center, or the earth was the center of the universe. In Copernicus's day, or maybe it was the guy before Copernicus. I'm terrible on science. I have to beg your forgiveness for this. Well, people built their models of science around that until they come to realize, no, it's actually the sun that's in the center of the universe, and that explains so much more. That's often the way science works. Science is always done by finite, flawed, and biased people. That is, science is done by human beings, which means sometimes they get it wrong. Sometimes, and I'm building this huge file of cases where scientists, in an attempt to make a name for themselves, have falsified their results and have said something that isn't true. Well, that doesn't mean we throw science out the window, because, again, science is a good gift from God. But we acknowledge that science, when they say trust the science, we have to ask the question, who's doing the science? How settled is the science? And when it comes to speaking about the nature of God, science is never going to discover something that will disprove God or disprove the central points of the Christian faith. Another limitation is science must be funded, and so is influenced by money. That is, in order to do science, you have to get grants and you have to have money provided because it's expensive. My son works for Dow Chemical over near Philadelphia, and he works for scientists and engineers who devise tests, and what his particular area is wire coatings. So he has a laboratory, works in a laboratory full of million-dollar machines, and a scientist will give him an experiment. He'll go in there, mix the stuff up, and he formulates a coating for wires. That's all he does all day long. And he runs these experiments. He says, Dad, if I do anything wrong, if there's too much humidity in the lab, if I add even, you know, a microgram more of this stuff than should be there, if it hasn't been stored properly, all these things can go wrong, which shows then that science is limited in its ability. And it has to be funded, which means that sometimes science gets misdirected into things it shouldn't be involved in. And scientists finally disagree all the time about all kinds of things. So again, this is not to put down science. It's a wonderful gift from God. We do realize that it has limitations. And for those who are material naturalists who believe science has the answer for everything, they often don't acknowledge the fact that science cannot answer everything. For example, science can tell us how to build a nuclear bomb, but it can't tell us whether it's right to drop one on someone, right? That's not a scientific question. That's a religious or philosophical question. Letter D, then. Notice, if everything we think is the result of random brain activity, why would we think that this theory is anything more than random brain activity that has no meaning? That is, for those that would say, listen, everything that happens is just random, then why would I think this idea is anything more than random? I know that's like makes your mind flip over a little bit, so bear with me. We expect statements to mean things, right? If I say Matt is not under arrest and there's no warrant out for his arrest right now, Pastor Matt, that makes sense to you, but then you're asking, why did he say that? Why did he have to say that? Maybe there is and he's lying. I don't know. No, we expect language to mean something, but if everything I say or think is a result of random brain activity, then why would I trust anything like that, right? And how many of you ever played Yahtzee growing up? 5 or 6 dice in a little plastic cup. You rattle it out there and you toss it on the table. If someone did that and threw those dice out there and they say, looking at those numbers, it looks like I should sell my car and get a new one. You would say, why do you think that? Well, just the roll of the dice indicates that. We'd say, I think you're basing your decisions on some really poor reasons. Why? Because we would recognize that's random. I mean, ultimately the Lord is sovereign over even the throw of dice. I get that. But we don't expect good reasons to be built on things that are random. Natural selection, that which guides the process of evolution, believed by material naturalists, it's all about the appropriate behavior for survival, not for the discovery of truth. So those who believe only that the natural world matters would say that the natural selection will sort things out. But natural selection is built for, if it's true, it's built for survival, not the discovery of truth. So those who believe in this basically are blindly trusting that some process which has no meaning or thought to it is going to somehow lead them to truth. That's one kind of atheist that you might meet. And we'll talk about how do we approach atheists at the end of this. Let's look at the other one, secular humanists. Secular humanism, this is on the back, places faith solely in human reason. And human reason as the bedrock upon which to build a progressive society. So this type of atheist is not really here about science, but just rather saying that people themselves and our own reason can solve our problems. This is my atheist friend back in Lancaster. His name's Scott. He doesn't really know much about science, but he tells me all the time, man will solve all his problems on his own. And I want to say to him, do you know anything about history? He also says, I believe the world is getting better all the time. And I say, you really should broaden your news sources. But he's convinced because of his belief in secular humanism that we can solve our own problems. And that's what secular humanism is all about. John Lennon of the Beatles was a secular humanist before he became a pantheist. He says, Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right and will be proved right. We call that aged like milk. That is, this did not age well because John Lennon is gone, but Christianity is not. But this is the attitude of secular humanists. It says we will eventually outgrow our need for God. However, sociologists are saying is that religion is on the rise, but so is unbelief. Well, how can that be? True, dedicated people who are religious are on the rise, and so are those who don't believe in God at all. You know what's falling? Is those who claim to be religious but don't really practice. And what's happening is that middle column of those who claim to be religious either find out that the religion is empty because there's no power, there's no gospel, there's no Christ in it. So they either come to Christ or they become secular. And we see that among Christian leaders or so-called Christian leaders who abandon the faith. In the last couple of years, some well-known, high-profile, formerly professing Christians are now atheists. Because at one point, they come to believe that, well, God doesn't really make sense in my story. That's the secular humanist model. Notice this, since human reason ought to guide our collective lives, religion must be kept out of the public square, or the public sphere, because of its very nature. So if you want to look at people who are opposing the right of Christians to speak publicly, that would be secular humanism. So there's a group that's been working for years to get removed from our dollar bills in God We Trust. Can I tell you as a Christian, I don't really care. The United States monetary system has never been built on a trust in God. It doesn't matter. What does matter is, as a Christian, am I still allowed to speak publicly about my faith? Can I express my faith at work? Can I express my faith publicly? That's what really matters. But secular humanists are hard at work to keep Christians and others out of this public sphere if they're religious. They believe human reason is the instrument and servant of the will. That is, we should not be having our thinking clouded by religion. Rather, we just choose to do things as people and we should do them. We're going to solve poverty. We're going to solve world hunger. And most of the people involved in those efforts have really good intentions, but they don't realize there are causes for those kinds of things. And if you don't address the cause, you can never deal with what is at the end. But I've read recently some secular humanists, they're saying, the sooner we get religion outlawed in the public sphere, the quicker we'll be able to solve our lives' problems. I think, again, you don't know history because that's not how it has worked. Religion, says the secular humanist, causes evil in the world through oppression, through intolerance and bigotry. And as I said at the beginning of the first hour, this is where we're coming to. We're quickly coming into a world where Christians now are considered to be oppressors. And we have to be gracious about that. What did Jesus say? Bless those who persecute you. It doesn't mean we remain silent, but we also don't. As Peter said, or as Paul says, our battle is not of this world. We don't take up arms as Christians to fight for our freedoms, as to express our faith. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, our warfare is a spiritual one. And the truth of the gospel has the power to tear down strongholds, to deconstruct those who would oppose the gospel. Notice the Marxist version of secular humanism says that by overthrowing the upper classes, this is letter F, an ideal society without greed and competition would emerge. Karl Marx taught this. He says if we can get rid of the upper middle classes, which include a lot of Christians, or if we can just get rid of things like private possessions and other things like that, then sin would basically go away. And Karl Marx taught that if we could get rid of religion was the opiate of the people, he thought. It was that which drugs people enough that they're not willing to rebel and to revolt. Well, that's kind of the way a lot of secular humanists feel. Get religion out of the way, we can finally arrive at the kind of world that we want to live in. So why is this wrong? What's wrong with secular humanism? If human reason is the instrument and servant of the will, it's under no obligation to choose the path of mercy, sympathy, or peace. See, some in the world, secular humanists, think we should get rid of Christianity because it's keeping us from getting to the point that we want. But the question is, if there's no God, why can't I choose cruelty and aggression? When you listen to secular humanists talk, they think that people are basically good, and if we get rid of religion, we will all treat one another kindly, we'll get along. We all know that's not the truth, don't we? Because if there is no God, and I'm blessed with power, I'm going to use that to exploit. And isn't really that the way most of the governments in the world work? Exploitation of the people. Think about all the leaders around the world that flee their countries as billionaires while their country starves to death. Why? Because in their ethic, there's no God to whom I'm accountable. I can do what I need to do, and I can exploit people. I don't have to choose mercy or sympathy or peace. Notice, secondly, one of the problems of secular humanism is that some of the most sweeping social transformations have begun from the conviction of the truth of Christianity. Let us think about William Wilberforce and the abolition of slavery. What drove William Wilberforce to spend his whole life opposing slavery? It's the belief in the dignity of man. What drove Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement? It was a belief in the dignity of humankind. And those who would try to teach a secular humanism have no answer for that. They would say, we should just be kind to one another, but that doesn't work in a world as broken as ours. Notice, thirdly, letter C, Marxism resulted in unprecedented poverty, government oppression, dehumanization, genocide. As you look at the Marxists of the 20th century, Stalin in Russia, Mao in China, Pol Pot in Cambodia, we could go on and on. What does that do? It causes oppression and death at an unparalleled scale. So that humanists can never seem to come to any agreement on anything without the use of power to enforce the opinion of certain humanists. This is what we're facing in our world today. And again, I don't think, hear me clearly, I don't think as Christians we should be spending all of our time shaking our fist at the darkness and cursing the darkness. Jesus has given us the light of the gospel. Be aware of the darkness, acknowledge it, be informed. But we don't go in a defensive model. We go in an offensive model with the gospel to lead people to Christ, to see them saved. That's our real message. So here's a few suggestions on reaching and engaging atheists and skeptics. Don't be intimidated by their hostility to Christianity. This is important. Atheists and skeptics love to be the hostile ones that intimidate Christians. One of our best graduates at Lancaster Bible College is now earning a degree in England. But he was in high school an atheist. He said, I love to intimidate Christians. He had these huge gauges in his ears and tattoos and nose rings. He was a skateboarder. And he was up in the face of Christians all the time, accusing them of evil in the world and of oppressing people. He said, until he came to realize, I think in his 10th or 11th grade year of high school, that he was empty and he had no answers, and he came to Christ and was radically saved. He ended up coming to Lancaster Bible College, and he's one of the most potent witnesses because he said, I remember those days. I love to intimidate Christians with my atheism. But he said, ultimately, it was all just a big show. And I've seen that over and over again. Don't be intimidated. In fact, when I meet someone who's an atheist, I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. Because most of the time they can dish it out and they can take it when I dish it out. But they're willing to talk. Why? Because their life is about suppressing the truth of what they know to be true. And they're working so hard to keep God out of their lives that God is on their mind all the time. So I love to meet people like that because generally they're willing to talk. Secondly, remember that they are more actively suppressing the truth of God than any other kind of unbeliever. That is, when I meet, again, someone who's religious, maybe even someone who claims to be a Christian, but trusts in their own good works, you know this, it's really hard to see them saved because they don't think they're lost. They're trusting in their own good works. They're full of self-righteousness and pride. That kind of person is hard to talk into the realization that they're trusting themselves and not Christ. But when you meet someone who's an atheist or a skeptic, they spend a lot of time thinking about what's wrong with Christianity, which means that they are fighting the truth of what they know to be true. They're pushing that down, suppressing that knowledge of God, and therefore I can talk openly and freely. Part of my son's job at Dow Chemical is that when they're waiting, he and the other lab technicians are waiting for the engineers to give him a job. Sometimes they sit around for hours, and he works with one radical skeptical guy. This guy asked 1,000 questions, doubts that he has about Christianity, reasons he doesn't believe it to be true. But my son says he tries to talk to those who are very religious, who don't know the Lord. Oh, no, thanks. I have my religion. Don't want to talk about it at all. So I would say don't be intimidated. See this as an open door. Don't let their opposition to God cause you to fear, as 1 Peter would say. Challenge them. What can you do with a skeptic? Usually they're big on, you've got to prove things to me. Challenge them with the verified history of the Gospels. One thing I want to remember whenever I talk to an unbeliever is I don't want to get stuck on secondary issues. I'm not trying to win them over to my view on the age of the earth. I have an opinion. It's not very scholarly. I try not to get stuck on issues of creationism. I'm a young earth creationist without apology. But I'm not trying to win them to that. I'm trying to win them to Christ. Stay focused on Jesus. Why? Because in the Gospels, we have the historical accounts of Jesus. And you know what? There are hundreds and hundreds of examples of evidence that point to the truth of that. The problem I see with a lot of Christians who are interested in apologetics, however, is they love to get into the details of non-essentials. I frankly don't care if a person that I'm talking to believes if God created the world. I don't care. Because if they come to Christ, that's going to be taken care of, right? So focus on Jesus. There's so much in the Gospels we can point to. This is historical evidence. You want to be skeptical? Let's take a look at the evidence for all the stuff in the Gospels. Bring them to Christ and all the secondary issues will be taken care of. Oh, let me just go back there. And focus on Jesus, not a vague notion of God. Sometimes in talking to people about the Gospel, we talk about you really need God in your life and you got to turn to God and God wants to solve your problems. Here's the problem with that, however. You don't really know what they think of when they think of God. You're thinking the Christian God. You have no idea what they're thinking. Get to Jesus. One of the things that came as a result of my cancer 2 years ago was I saw the same doctors and nurses and physicians' assistants over and over again. And God opened up some wonderful opportunities to share the Gospel there. Because I'm stuck in the room, they're doing a procedure, so I'm realizing they can't leave me. So let's talk about the Lord and open up the door. Remember one very skeptical physician's assistant. She was related. I think her brother-in-law worked with me at the Bible College. So her brother-in-law is a Christian. And I said to her one day, I said, so, Caitlin, where do you go to church? And she goes, well, we're not churchgoers. I assumed because she was related to this coworker of mine that she was. I said, oh, I just assumed that you were a Christian since your brother-in-law is. She goes, no, no. And she didn't seem to want to talk about it. So I dropped it for a little while. But internally I'm praying and saying, Lord, should I bring it up again? And later in the meeting, she said, okay, well, that's about it. Do you have any other questions? And I said, you know what? I'm going to go for it. So I said, so let me ask you a question. So you're not a churchgoer. Do you believe in God at all? She says, well, I don't really know. So I said, Lord, you got to give me some good questions to ask here to get this conversation going. So I said this, and I've asked a lot of doctors this. Have your studies in science and your working with suffering people led you more to a belief in God or away from a belief in God? It's a really good question to ask. I had an oncologist at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia say, I've never thought about that before. To be honest, I don't really think about God much, and his suffering led me to God. He, like, contemplated it for a long time. But back to this girl, Caitlin. She's like, probably my study in science led me away from God. I said, okay, so you think science points away from God? Yeah, I do. I said, who do you think Jesus is? Because you don't want to get stuck on God, because the gospel is about Christ. It's not that Jesus is separate from God. We're well aware of the Trinity. But I want to get to the historical Christ. And she said, well, I think he was a good man. I trust that he said really good things. I said, well, do you believe the other things? Do you believe that when he said that he is God in the flesh, do you believe that? Well, I don't know. Do you believe that he's the only way to God? Because he said that also. I'm not so sure about that. I said, well, to be intellectually honest with Jesus, you've either got to accept who he says he was or reject it. And then I said this. I said, honestly, if I wasn't a Christian, I would have no respect for Jesus. And she said, really? I said, yeah, because he claimed to be God. He claimed to be the only way to salvation. He claimed that anyone who rejected him would never see God. And so I either have to believe him and be honest with that, or I have to say, I can't believe anything he says. I remember her saying, I think I need to go back and read the Gospels again. She said, you've really challenged me. I think I'm intellectually dishonest with Jesus. So we need to get to Jesus in our conversations. Don't just talk about God. Force the question of who was Jesus. And that's an easy one to show. Either accept him for who he says he is, because it's not intellectually honest to say, well, I accept some of the things that he says and not others. Then you shouldn't accept him. As C.S. Lewis said, he's either a liar, he's not who he says he was, or he was a lunatic, he was a crazy man who thought he was God, or he truly is Lord. And some in our day say there's a fourth option, it could have been a legend, but here's the problem with the idea of a legend. Legends sprang up hundreds of years after the people that they were about. The Gospels are written within 20 to 30 years of Jesus' life. And as Paul says in 1 Corinthians, there's still a lot of people around who saw him with their own eyes. Go ask them if you don't believe him. So in your conversations, get to Jesus. And then finally, challenge them to present a rational case for morals and justice, as we said in the previous hour. Everyone believes that there are some things that are wrong. Everyone desires justice and asks the question, in your worldview, what you believe, how does that make sense? Because here's how it makes sense in the Christian worldview. So if you're interested, if you talk to or work with someone who's an atheist, there's two books out there. One's a little one called Engaging with Atheists, Understanding Their World and Sharing Good News. And then a bigger one by a guy who was an atheist, How to Be an Atheist, Why Many Skeptics Aren't Skeptical Enough. So let me encourage you to think through that. We have time for some questions. Questions on anything we've talked about this hour or just in general? And we'll take one more break, then we'll come back for our last session on how should Christians think about LGBTQ. Yes. How? Yeah. Absolutely, if I'm going to share the gospel or give an answer, I point out the fact that there is a God who has revealed himself. He created this world for his glory. He made us in his image. So yes, all that matters. What I don't want to get hung up on is questions of the age of the earth or all the details of creation that involve scientific questions. Now, if you are scientifically minded and you have that ability, go for it. And I highly respect ministries like Institute for Creation Research and Answers in Genesis. Please, yeah, thank you, Matt. I appreciate the clarification here. That God created and that we're made in his image and that the fall has brought a curse in this world is of utmost importance. One of the things I am very cautious about, people who get too far into creation studies, is they never get to Jesus in their conversations. They're so trying to prove the details of creation that drive people away. That's why I try to stay off the issue. However, I always argue from the presupposition that God did create the world and we're in his image and all that. Thank you. Follow up on that at all? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm not arguing for it unless they need me to argue for it, because when I say, because God created us in his image, every one of us has dignity, most unbelievers I meet agree with that. But they don't know how to explain why they believe that. So if they need me to get into, here's why I believe we have dignity, well, I believe God created the world. He made us in his image, different from the animals. I will get into that, but I will basically point out your impulse or your intuition that we should care for one another only makes sense in the Christian worldview. So I don't have to get into the whole creation story unless they want to. But most of the time when I talk to unbelievers, they already believe we should treat one another with kindness and dignity. I could say, you're exactly right, but why do you believe that? Here's why I believe it. Yeah. So my point is, I don't want to get hung up in a conversation unless that's their big objection. I want to get to Jesus as fast as I can. I talk about that in my book. It's not that I want to ignore their questions, but not everyone has questions about creationism. Yeah. I hope I'm being clear about that. Great question. Somebody else, another question? Yes. Yeah. So the question is, if we ask people, why do you think things about the morals that you hold to? Here's the answer I would give you. I'm not a scientifically minded person. I know philosophy really well. Philosophically, if there is no God who created this world and has revealed truth and morality in the Bible, there is no way you can consistently say something like torturing children is wrong. Philosophically, you're just saying I don't like it, but you can't say it's wrong unless there's a God transcendent outside of us who has revealed himself and made the world that way. So the unbelievers you meet, 100%, my guess, will say, yes, torturing children is wrong. Why? Well, everyone knows. No, that's not good enough. Everyone doesn't know because people do it. So why do you think torturing children is wrong? I believe it because God made the world. He made us in his image. We have dignity. Human life matters, and he's commanded us to love one another, not torture one another. What is your reason for disliking it? Push them to provide a basis for morality, and I can tell you philosophically, all they can say is I don't like it, but they can't say there's any reason why it's wrong. Yeah, that's a good one. And this is where we can appeal. Again, every person I talk to is made in God's image, and this is God's world. So when they're trying to resist the truth of God, they're going against everything about reality. So we have that on our side. And they'll have two intuitions. We should be fair and just to one another. We should treat one another with kindness and dignity. We should care for people who are down and out. Most people feel that way. Well, all those things are consistent with the Christian worldview. But if we're just animals out in the jungle, there's no reason why I should care about you. And so I have a good reason to explain why they feel the ways that they do. That's great. Somebody else? We have time for a couple more questions before we take one more break. Yes. Yes. That's a great point. So what about people who don't actually practice what they say they believe? My guess is if you ask the average person, should we treat one another with kindness? They're going to say yes. When we ask the question, so how do we explain people that don't? Their answers could vary for a number of reasons. And the reason is we are never fully consistent with our beliefs. Let's take Christians, for example. We're told our love our neighbor as ourselves. Do we do that perfectly? I don't. So I can say to someone who points out something like that, like, yeah, you're right. We all fail to live up to what we say is right. Let's acknowledge that. Let's acknowledge that Christians sometimes treat people horribly. But so do unbelievers, so do atheists, so do skeptics, so do Hindus, so do Buddhists, people of peace. It really doesn't matter who you are. In practice, we never live up to our ideals, but I would ask them, what should be the ideals that guide our lives? And how does that make sense in your worldview? Let's acknowledge that we all fail to do that perfectly. So I would go after, you know, not how do we actually live, but how do we say we should live, and what's the basis for that? Does it make sense to say we should treat one another with dignity? Well, this world evolved, and there's just blind time and chance, and we're just animals programmed by our DNA. That doesn't make sense. But in the Christian worldview, it does, and the reason ultimately is pointed out when we see the life of Jesus. He who is innocent was treated as if he was guilty. He who is rich became poor for our sakes. Sometimes I can even turn an objection like that to who Jesus is, and that dispels the tension about a moral issue, because I'm, again, turning the discussion toward Jesus. That's a great question. I'm sure I didn't answer it adequately. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. We'll come back here right at 2 minutes till 8, and we're going to touch on the one of the hottest topics today is how should Christians think about LGBTQ. And I actually have boiled down a 6-hour lecture that I do at the college in my ethics class down to about 50 minutes. So hang on, put your seatbelts on. We're going to go fast in about 10 minutes.